Okay, Shreach Meni, good morning, everyone. Parshas Va'era is a very, very exciting parsha. We have the first seven of ten Makos. We have the Dalad Lashon Shel Geula, the excitement of the Jewish people and the process of Geula. Already began last week with Moshe Rabbeinu going to the Jewish people, finally going, leaving Midian, going to Mitzrayim, and getting the Jewish people started. However, it starts on a downturn. At the end of the parsha, Paro tells Moshe, sounds great, but you're getting the people too excited. You're excited, therefore I'm going to add more work to them. The straw's going to go away. They're going to have to work much harder in order to make these bricks and fashion these bricks for me. And that's what we pick up at the beginning of the parsha, where Moshe now needs to really excite and ignite the Jewish people again. The Torah tells us, L'chein amor l'vnei Yisrael, ani Hashem. Hashem tells Moshe, the dal l'shono shel geula. As a result of the dal l'shono shel geula, we drink four cups of wine at the Pesach Seder. The truth is there aren't four expressions of geula. There are really five expressions of geula. V'otzeiti, v'itzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti, and v'havesi. It's not just enough to receive the Torah. We need to get into Eretz Yisrael. Last year, we discussed the notion of Eretz Yisrael being a morasha and what that means. But let's really now focus on the first one. The first one is, Votseisi eschem mitachas sivlos mitzrayim. I'm going to help you leave the sivlos mitzrayim. This language comes up numerous times in the Parshios of Mitzrayim. We have Moshe saying, Vayar b'sivlosa. The first time Moshe goes out to see the Jewish people, to see his brethren, it's Vayar b'sivlosam. He sees the sivlosam. What does that word mean? What is sivlosam? The burden. So the classic interpretation is where Rashi says on one of these psukim, I'm not sure, I don't remember which one, Sivlos here, Torech Masa Mitzrayim, the burdens of the servitude of Egypt. I'm going to take you out of the burdens of the servitude of Egypt. That is a simple interpretation of what this means here. However, both the Ger Rebbe and who is this? The Menachem Sion, they both say the same idea. Sivlos also comes from a word, if you're listening from Israel. How do you say patience in Hebrew?
Savlanu.
Savlanu. If you went to an Ivrit high school, which I did, Yeshiva Flatbush, then you know what the word Savlanu means because every teacher says it about 30 times a day, right? Savlanu. Bevakasha. Savlanu. It's that and the word for Hebrew word for gum. Okay? Mastic, for anyone curious. So, Savlanu. Sivlos Mitzrayim comes from the word Savlanu. Now, what does that mean? I'm going to take you out of the savlanut of Mitzrayim. So the way that the Ger Rebbe says it is that when Moshe, Vayar b'sivlosam, Moshe saw the Jewish people slaves, they were completely comfortable in the position that they were in. They were okay from patience. They were okay with the state that they were in. You need to leave? No. Because 210 years into being slaves, they've accepted where they were in life. They've accepted their lot in life as being slaves. It was okay to them. It was fine. It was justified. They asked no questions about it. They were totally comfortable with this position. Yeah.
They also didn't know anything better.
Right. They didn't know anything better. 100%. They didn't know anything better from where they were. So Hashem says, the first thing I need to do, the first stage of Geula is to rattle you up and to awaken you to understand that you shouldn't be slaves, that this is not okay. Votseisi, right? Vitzalti, Votseisi, Eschem Mitachas, Sivlos Mitzrayim. Before I even physically take you out of Egypt, emotionally, spiritually, the first step is to understand that this is not okay. Before we go on to to physically taking you out of Egypt. Yes?
If you also know that it's supposed to be there for 100 years, so it's not harming you.
Correct. We discussed that last Shabbos as to why 400 years, Hashem needed to convince Moshe why 400 years was not a go, and they were going to be taken out earlier. 100%. Then maybe that's why they were okay with this status right now. But we become so accustomed to the status quo or where we are. And maybe that's not okay. We become too sovel, too patient with positions that we're in or things that we do in our life. And for our personal selves and our growth itself, there needs to be a certain level of impatience or comfortability in our growth. Growth can only come from being uncomfortable in a part of our life. So Moshe, the Jewish people, need to be rattled a little bit in their life to get to this stage to want to leave Egypt itself. Yeah.
There's a big difference between acceptance and comfort.
Acceptance and comfort.
Every Golos that the Jews live, they have to accept the Golos, but many of the Golos, they became comfortable.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Abe, you're making a great point. Accepting Gullus might be just our fate, but to be comfortable in the Gullus to where we don't need to go to Eretz Israel. We don't need to move things along. That's unacceptable on its own. The Medrash writes that no Egyptian slave ever left. So it could be speaking to the great, officers of Egypt. They were so powerful, so strong, and when the security systems were so excellent that no one was physically able to leave. And that maybe is true. I saw an interpretation by Rav Gedalia Shor where he writes, it's not speaking about how great big their fences were, how powerful their men were that no one ever escaped. Nobody ever wanted to escape Egypt. They convinced you in Egypt that being a slave for Paro was better than being a free man in Midian and Moab or in the Plishti lands. This was like the greatest thing that you can do of nobility, to be a slave in Egypt. Sure, you're eating, drinking matzah and water all day long. That was better than doing anything else, to be a slave for Paro. They convinced them of that. And the Jewish people needed to not be unaccepting of that fate. Okay, continuing on. So Moshe now tells the Jewish people, these, five Lashonos HaGeulah. It's unbelievable. It's so exciting. It's so inspiring. Vayidaber Moshe Kenel B'nei Yisrael, V'lo Shamu El Moshe, Mikotzer Ruach, U'me Avodah Kasha. Literally means, Moshe tells them all of this, and they can't hear it. They can't hear it. Mikotzer Ruach, because of their kotzer ruach, Rashi writes, "Kol misha who meitzar rucho neshimaso k'tzara v'ne yachol laharich b'neshimaso." They were lacking breath, meaning when you're a slave for so long, you can't think about anything else but being a slave. Right? Therefore, Moshe, what you're saying is so nice, it's so beautiful. That's not how we are. Kotzer ruach, avoda kasha. We have no time for you. We have no breaks in our day to think about these things. If we don't get the bricks done by today, we're going to get beaten. That is our one sole focus and purpose right now on this earth. We can't think about these glorious Torah, Israel. Forget about it. We need to focus on what is going on right now. The Nitziv, one second, man, he makes a shocking comment. He writes here, Kotzer ruach avoda kasha, shehein mishukayim b'avoda zara. What this is referring to is not the emotional state of the Jewish people. It's referring to the spiritual state of the Jewish people. Spiritually, they were cleaving to avoda zara, idol worship, at these moments. And they didn't want to leave to worship one God. They were okay worshiping just like the Egyptians were in Egypt. Yeah, Mendy.
I was really blind to sometimes a question around this did Kaddish Barbara's Kaddish Barbara's. We see over and over that if the collateral is fine, how the slave that we have,
say, I can't hear you. Say it again.
We see if the big come out.
Yeah.
Being slaves, have the slave mentality over and over again, more than that, to be in places. Okay? So why do they have the slave in this line? So, to the point that so long we can say now, how they why would this time? Why could it be for a much shorter time than they were?
Yeah,
some effect had to happen, but not to the point that it helps us to believe it has to.
So, Mendy wanted to know why, wants to know, great question. Why is it that they need to stay in Egypt for so long? Couldn't these, all these very important lessons and educational, you know, ideals be taught to them in a much shorter length of time?
It's because we see it, the fact that it hasn't been that long. It didn't go around.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question.
Apparently, if at the throne of God, this is the way to do it, then you're asking, then you're saying, why did God have to go this way? This way would work better than other ways.
Maybe it would have been worse, but we see certain results in it, which that it was a problem. The slave mentality was their dominance.
But the results might have been worse.
It could have been.
Maybe next week we'll discuss it when in Parsha's book when they talk about the amount of years. But these are all good questions. You know, there was a reason. This is part of the divine plan. What exactly was the reason? We could discuss. Is it humility? Is it so we then, as a nation, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years later, can care about, you know, those that are weaker in society, those that are oppressed, and have a great understanding of them. And that needs to be inculcated into the DNA and the genetics of the Jewish people. Those are very important. So with a shorter amount of time, I don't know if we get there. I don't know if we get there. And you're right, but that has negative effects, because in the immediate negative effect of the next 40 years, we want to go back. Over and over again. So with any good educational, you know, model of going into Egypt for so long, it's going to come with some, you know, negative repercussions as well.
Maybe you have to say it's a short-term and long-term effect that affects us today.
Yeah.
And maybe we are also thousands of years, but we're a byproduct of that.
Yeah.
You mentioned it every single day. So the short term maybe was not a good thing, but obviously in the very long term it was.
Yeah. These are all great points. So we have to think about it more. I want to just a complete twist on Kotzer Ruach and Avodah Kasha. All the Mefarshim understand Kotzer Ruach and Avodah Kasha as pinningness on the Jewish people. The Jewish people couldn't listen to Moshe because they had Kotzer Ruach and Avodah Kasha. What was it exactly? I don't know, Rashi says one opinion, the Mitziv says a different one. The Rabbalk here says something completely different. They couldn't listen to Moshe, Mikotzer Ruach. Whose Kotzer Ruach was this? It was Moshe's. He says that Moshe was getting fed up with his people. He just met them, right? It was pretty, but he was getting fed up with them. And the way that Moshe was conveying the message to the Jewish people, there was something missing from it. Whether it was like not completely genuine, or there was a tinge of cynicism or anger or resentment in there, there was something in there that forced the Jewish people to not completely buy into his message. So Mikotzer Ruach and Avodah Kasha, it was like the harsh tone, the negativity. There was something there. Mikotzer Ruach Moshe Lizbonim Mesidat Torah, Karoi. the way Moshe was telling it over to them was not done well. And therefore, they didn't listen to him. They themselves did not listen to him. Yes.
When you have to convey something there, like you have to believe in yourself, you know, believe in yourself, it's not going to be transmitted anymore.
100%. Right? You need to believe in yourself as a leader. Maybe it was on him. Yeah.
Why would they trust him? He grew up in Paris.
Yeah.
So he could have been just fine with them. And then at some point, he abandoned everybody and left his wife. Now he comes back with these grandiose ideas. He's going to take him out of his wife. He could sound like a woman with it.
He's an outsider. He's an outsider. So how can they, why would they listen to him? You know, that could be part of why he was not interested. Like he was concerned with going and he was hesitant. But the truth is that's related to the different signs that he gives him. A code Bacchadity is part of that. Yeah, Abe?
With all due respect to the Rambam, there's a reason why none of the other Persian sages.
Correct.
They all obviously didn't hold that.
Right.
The two reasons given, because of Ruach and the Avodah Kosha. So, thematically, it's maybe Shroud that could have listened to Moshe. It's not that. I mean, it's nice. It's like a Hasidisha, it's like a Hashir Shabbat, also on the leadership. But it's not a Pashup Shah.
I hear you. It's not a Pashup Shah. But I think it is very interesting. How we convey messages to others, we have to think about how we speak. How we talk about it, the text, but the context of it is very, very significant. And that gets onto another aspect of Moshe's speech.
Moshe. Rabbi Markowitz, what's the possibility?
Yeah, go ahead.
The fact that he couldn't express himself. He had a problem.
Very good.
He couldn't speak. He was a stutterer. How could he keep the attention of these people?
Very good. So that is perfectly works next. What does this mean? Moshe is an Arel Sfasayim. He says it again here. I'm an Arel Sfasayim. The Jewish people will listen to me. How can Paro listen to me? Why would Hashem do this to Moshe?
Right.
What's the purpose of this? By the way, there happen to be several different languages about Moshe's difficulty with speech. Sometimes he says, I'm an Arel Sfasayim. Sometimes he writes, I'm a Kvad Peh, Kvad Lashon Anokhi. There are different ways that this is expressed in the Torah. Now, what exactly does this mean? Rabbi Lapp pointed out that one interpretation is that he is an Arel Sfasayim, which he stutters. That is one way to express this. Other Mefarshim say that he couldn't say or express certain letters. He had a lisp, and he couldn't pronounce them the right way. Others say this is something completely different, is that Moshe said, I can't speak sophisticatedly. You're asking me to speak to the king of Egypt. I don't know how to speak to the king of Egypt. I ran away from Egypt. I've been living in Midian for 40 plus years. I don't know how to speak the king's language anymore. So ask somebody else. Why would it be that a Kadosh Baruch Hu would give the no Sein HaTorah, right? The one that ultimately not only gave the Torah, but taught the Torah to the Jewish people, something wrong with his speech? Yeah.
Very bad, and we will have something with us, right? And I'm perfect. And then the growth that happens,
yeah,
you succeed,
yeah,
it can turn your whole life around. And I think he did for Moshe, and even here for Paro as well. Paro seeing, look at this person at the end of time when Paro told him failed,
yeah,
having a person like this. To Hashem, take him out. For both of them,
Correct.
It works in a very special way.
So Mendy said that it teaches imperfection. None of us are perfect. So lest you think that the only people that can get close to God are people that are perfect and have, you know, check all, literally all the boxes. It's not true. Even the one that started this all, our greatest leader, was somebody that was completely imperfect. Just to add to
Rabbi?
That.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
It's Sharon Korpel. I had heard, I'm sorry, I don't know who the Mefarish is.
Yeah.
That it was in order to emphasize the fact that the message is what was most important. Not, yeah. You know, sometimes we listen to someone and we're so wowed by their English accent, or the content isn't so important. It's right. And we get lost in the oratory and the delivery. And the point was that it was Hashem's message that was of most importance and not the way that it was delivered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is the approach of the Drash HaSaran.
He
wanted to point out, he said, this is very significant. It wasn't because Moshe was a charismatic leader that the Jewish people followed him, but it was to show that it was the content of the Torah itself that was significant. And that was overly emphasized every time. They weren't listening or following Moshe because of his abilities as a speaker, as an orator. No, it was the Torah itself was what sold. It was the Torah itself was what sold. And the Shlach HaKadosh makes the following amazing statement. The Torah says, by Matan Torah, that we heard and saw the kolos. So we learned from there that anybody that was unable to hear or anybody that was unable to see, all at Matan Torah, everybody was cured. Any disability that somebody had was automatically cured at Matan Torah. The Shla writes, everybody except for Moshe. Moshe's speech difficulty, whatever it is, whatever it was, still stayed. Moshe needed to have that. He writes it in Moshe needed it to keep himself, you know, level and keep himself humble. He needed to remember the miracle of whether this is, he said it relates back to the gold versus coal. Then he was saved as a young baby by the Malach pushing his hand towards the coal versus the gold. Whether it was that or to continue this message that the Torah itself is what is significant and the Torah itself is what should sell and nothing else. Sure, it's great to hear Shir from somebody with an excellent accent or a great orator. And that's, yeah, for sure we choose them. But it's the Torah itself that should sell. This, I think, is a very important message, especially when considering what we teach, what content we teach children about the parasha. Something that I'm, you know, nitpicky about, but you know, I feel very strongly, you teach them the Torah, the Midrashim come later. Midrashim, the Torah itself should sell on its own. Just on its own. Sure, sometimes even good pictures, but the Midrashim, they should come a little bit later. You know, sometimes we sell kids on it. This is what happened. Maybe. I mean, the Midrash is a whole different discussion as to, did it happen? Is this historical? What does it mean? But it's very important to teach the content of the Torah. That should sell on its own. Everything else should come later. Yeah.
At the end of the day, actually, Hashem says, I will speak to Moshe, and Moshe will give the message to Aaron. So Aaron became the speaker, not Moshe.
That was true to Paro, right? I don't know if that was true
to the Bnei Yisrael.
Yeah, and that furthers this point, right? To Paro, to speak in a sophisticated manner or to speak in a certain way, they needed Aaron to be his Nivi'echa, but right. Not when it came to, you know, the Jewish people.
But why didn't Hashem cure him? Why didn't he give him a refuah for his problem?
So either because he needed to be continued, you know, maybe this could get to his head, or that the Jewish people needed to be reminded of this message. It's the content of the Torah itself is why we follow the Torah, and not because of who is teaching.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you have a teacher who teaches without love, or in a way that he doesn't care, you turn off the students.
You are correct. You are correct that that's what happens. But we're adults here and we're sophisticated. We have to, you know, that's sometimes we're imprinted by what happens when we're younger. But ideally, it should be the Torah itself that, you know, we shouldn't judge Judaism by the Jews. Judaism should be judged by the Torah itself and its values on its own. So even though that does happen, unfortunately, with bad mechanchim or even, you know, worse, that, you know, commit crimes or take advantage of their positions, we shouldn't judge Judaism by those individuals, but by the content of the Torah itself. And I think that's a deeper, further message of the Ran.
I'm thinking of children and young students. Same idea.
Yeah.
Rabbi, question. So I'm confused.
Yeah.
Go all the way around. So we learn the lesson of why Moshe was physically challenged in speaking. So why did somebody get a patch for this?
What do you mean?
You said there's a negative on this.
What do you mean the negative on this?
That's what you started with. There was something wrong with the way he delivered the message, that Klal Yisrael wasn't getting it.
Oh, that's a different word. Kotzer Ruach. It wasn't there was because he wasn't passionate about it. He was negative about it. That wasn't about the way that he spoke. It was the
yeah. Okay.
That was a different thought. Okay. In the context, it happens to be that all of our ideas, except for one, we're going to see all come from the very beginning. I mute everybody. Everyone's very excited today. Baruch Hashem. So come from the beginning of the parasha. So the beginning of the parasha, once they mention Moshe and Aaron, the Torah goes out of its way to speak about the yichus, the genealogy, the children of Reuven, Shimon, and then back to Levi. And it's a very strange thing. And the simple understanding, Rashi and other Mefarshim say, is that once they want to show the yichus of Moshe and Aaron and where they come from, they're just going to start from the beginning of the Shvatim, Reuven, Shimon, and then talk about Levi. And that's why the yichus is mentioned in the beginning of the parsha, which within itself begs a lot of questions as to what we're so careful with every single word and letter, and why is that necessary over here? So I want to share with you a thought from a sefer called Chamin B'Motzei Shabbos, which has been difficult to receive. Chamin B'Motzei Shabbos, what it literally means, a great name for a sefer. Chamin, yeah, Chamin in Hebrew is the like what they call cholent. You know cholent? So in Hebrew, when Israelis call, you know, people call cholent chamin. So you have a good piece of food on Motzei Shabbos. So what is this sefer? The sefer was written by it's a Tolna Rebbe. I believe this Tolna Rebbe lives in Renana. Fascinating person, Rav Weinberg. And it's his Divrei Torah that he gave at a Malav HaMalka. So it's called Chamin, like some good food on Motzei Shabbos, some good Torah on Motzei Shabbos. It's hard to find in America. The thing Zev Jarishau, two, three years ago, he picked up Shemosin Bayikra for me in Eretz Israel. So he makes the following ha'ara. He makes the following ha'ara, Pidrush. I'm going to say it out there right now. Okay? It's Alpidrush. Says the following. He says, if you go back just to Parshas Vayechi, you'll notice that all the brothers get blessings from their father Yaakov. When you further analyze those blessings, three of the brothers, it's not really a blessing. It's really a patch, right? Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. So he says the following. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi were, because of that, became more aware or hyper-focused on the negative side of their midos, right? They were concerned with what Yaakov said. So they tried to hone in and focus in their children and their grandchildren to inculcate these traits in the positive way. Try to, you know, hone it and push it towards positive way. So the Torah wants to point out here that several generations later, again, Vayechi is 200 years approximately after Vayera, is 200 years after Vayechi, is that the Torah wants to say that they all turned out okay. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, the Torah now is going back over them, doing Chazara, and saying, look at these children, look at the traits that the great-grandparents had. They were questionable, because they could have gone this way, and they could have gone that way. But look how they watched after it, and they ensured, and they safeguarded it. They didn't push them away, and they didn't, no, but they ensured that these traits were done in a healthy way to help society. And therefore, when they received this tochacha from Yaakov, it helped them foster positivity in the next generations by not, you know, by people not do, you know, changing who they were, but helping, you know, develop these midos in the proper way to help the Jewish people. And that's
Rabbi. Yeah. Question is, what did Levi do? It doesn't really tell us much, and maybe this is part of it. What did Levi do to reform himself through tshuva so that he would be the, even in Egypt, he was going to be part of the Levi class, the new class of priests and whatever. What does he do?
We don't, you're asking a good question. We don't know exactly what they did, but we do know is that the Amram did become the Gadol Hador. Amram did become the de facto leader for the Jewish people before Moshe came on the scene, before even his kid, when his kids were very young. The Rambam writes about that explicitly, that Amram established certain halachos in Egypt to help the Jewish people, foster a sense of community and a sense of learning, that there was something that was with Levi, definitely. And, it, you know, there could be hints here and there, you know, along the way. It's hard to know because there, you know, the story in Shmos goes very much out of the, it's very individual focused in Bereishis, and now it's more national focused, and we don't really know much about it moving forward. Yeah, someone else had a question? I think Jay? No. Okay, last thought for today is from the Makkah of Kenan. So what happens is that over the Makos, there's a lot of different things we could focus on in the Makos. Now, obviously, the Makkah itself and the significance of why that Makkah needed to come now. And there's always a Mida Keneged, Mida corollary to the Egyptians. There's also something fascinating to discuss in the how the Makkah ended. Every Makkah ends differently. Did Moshe need to daven for the Makkah? Did the Makkah end on its own? Did the animals run away? Did they stay? A lot of fascinating discussions there. You can make a chart for yourself, and everyone's very, very different. Also, is the interactions between Paro and Moshe, and between the Chartume Mitzrayim and Moshe and Aaron. You know, they try to do it. Could they do it? Could they not do it? So the first two Makos, it's very, very clear that they were able to copy exactly what Moshe and Aaron did. So Moshe and Aaron hit the water, they made blood. So the Chartume Mitzrayim were able to copy that. When Tzfardea came, the same thing was able to happen. They were able to copy, emulate that. When it comes to Kenim, the third Makkah, the Torah tells us, Periches, Pasuk Yudalid, Vayasu Kena Chartume Balatehem, they attempted to, with their sorcery, make Kenim. And they were unable to make the kinim. And the kinim were there. The Chartumim now say to Paro, Etzba Elokim hi. We realize now that this is the hand of God or the finger of God. And it's not them. They're not magicians. They're not tricking us. It's really coming straight from their God. Vayechazakli, Paro strengthens heart. Lo shema, lehem, he doesn't listen to them. Kasher diber Hashem. Now, what was it about Kenan that they couldn't do this? What was it about Kenan that they couldn't copy this? So there's several, it's a fascinating discussion in the Rishonim. What was it? I think of a very important lessons here. The Chizkuni writes that magic, or this impure tuma type of magic, whatever you want to call it, only works when you're, one of the rules is it only works when you're standing on the ground. When it came to Kenan, the Chartumim didn't realize this, but all of the ground was already full of lice. So nobody was really standing on the ground when they were attempting to make their own Kenan. They were standing on Kenan, right? This gives you an appreciation of what was happening here. So Chizkuni writes, they're standing on top of Kenan. Therefore, every single time they try to say their magic words and try to make their incantation, it just didn't work. It didn't work in that way because practically they weren't standing on the ground. The Ramban writes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself intervenes in this moment. Why is that? The Rambam writes, everything was a sleight of hand. Right? This is Rambam's approach to magic in general. It's not real at all. The Torah says you can't do it. You can't make a sleight of hand. The Ramban writes, it's real. There's a real tuma out there that you can do these things in. And he writes that it would be too dangerous to allow the Chartum of Mitzrayim to follow this one and to make Kenan. Not because Kenan was so bad, but because at this point it would be a chazakah. Dam, Sardeya, Kenan would be number three, be a chazakah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want a chazakah with the Egyptians. Maybe it would further convince Paro of everything, or further convince the Egyptians of what was going on. And that within itself would be dangerous. And he didn't want that to happen. He didn't want that to happen. Therefore, God intervened and ensured that this one didn't happen. Therefore, they didn't really try after that. Rashi, which is maybe what we are most familiar to, Rashi says here, why can't we? Why couldn't they copy this? Shane Hashed Sholate Alberia Chusa Miksor. That demons don't have control over things that are smaller than a barley seed. Lice are smaller than barley seeds. Therefore, they don't have control over it. Now, what does that mean that the Shadim or this Tuma does not have control over things that are that small? So this two interpretations here that are very, very fascinating. The Maharal, in his Sefer Gur Aryeh, writes that something so small, less than a barley seed, is batel to the ground. It's not considered chashiv on its own. It's like the ground. It's so small, it's very insignificant. They don't have their independent identity. They're buttons of the world. And they were only in control of things that could stand on their own. So blood is an independent identity. Sardeya is an independent. They're only in control of those things. Anything that did not have its own independent identity, the Egyptian magicians could not be in control over. And Kenan were just one of those things that they were not in control over. That is the approach of the Maharaj. Rav Kook writes something, I think, very, very fundamental about this Rashi and really about Judaism in general. He writes, one of the things that makes Am Yisrael, I think probably even building off of the Maharal, one of the things that makes Am Yisrael so special is that everything is dictated by halacha, everything, Kadosh Baruch Hu cares about everything. Meaning, there's nothing that's big and nothing that's small. Everything is equal, right? It's big, the small, everything in Judaism matters. Whether it's you tying your shoes, or the way that you get married, right? Or the way that we keep Shabbos. There are big things on Shabbos, and there are small things on Shabbos. Whether it means you separate the jelly beans, or it's the cooking on Shabbos, or just having a Shabbos atmosphere, lighting the candles. There's no big things and small things in Shabbos. But when it comes to Tumah or other religions, he writes, so sometimes things are too small, they're insignificant, they don't matter. They don't matter. We never say that. We never say, there's no safer that says, this thing, don't worry about it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. No. Everything matters when it comes to Yiddishkeit. That could drive you crazy, but that also means that everything is significant. Everything can be inspiring. Everything could be used as a tool to connect to a Kaddish Baruch Hu and to get closer to him. Therefore, he says this, what the Chartumi Mitzrayim couldn't do, is not something that, okay, it was a technicality and they couldn't do it. No, but it really reflected the nature of other religions versus Klal Yisrael, versus Judaism, Yiddishkeit. That for its other these small things or these small people, that for us, everyone and everything matters and is significant on its own. And that's why they couldn't do it and we could.
Rabbi, Markowitz, there's a medrash that says that Yaakov Avinu knew that there was going to be a makkah of Kenim, and yes, he did not want to be buried in Mitzrayim. He wanted to be out of there. I don't want anything to do with Kenim.
Yeah, that is a great point. That is a great point. Yeah, but what does that mean? Because Yaakov was Jewish, so Yaakov got affected by the Kenim. It really matters. Think about that. Okay, so let's review. Let's review today. We discussed Lo Shamo Moshe Mekotzer Ruach. Kotzer Ruach, what is the Kotzer Ruach? Is it a slave mentality? Is it a spiritual issue? Or the Rabbah says it is a messaging issue with Moshe Rabbeinu. Mitacha Sivlos Mitzrayim. What does Sivlos Mitzrayim means? It comes from Savlanut. They're so accustomed to being slaves. They didn't know any other lifestyle. And Moshe needed to convince them otherwise. Why is Moshe considered Arel Sfasayim? Why is that something significant for the leader of Klal Yisrael to have? We discussed different approaches to this. The Drasha Saran / Sharon Karpel said it's about the content of the Torah itself, but not about who or how it was being said. The notion that Torah needs to be something that teaches Torah, regardless of the fancy nature around it. We discussed the implications of that. We discuss why Reuben, Shimon, and Levi are singled out over here in giving their genealogy. And finally, we discussed different reasons why the Chartumi Mitzrayim could not copy the Mak of Kenim, the Chizkuni, the Ramban, Rashi, and then two approaches within Rashi between the Maharal and Rav Kook. Wish everybody a great Shabbos and a wonderful day.
Shabbos.
You too.
Yeah, I should call, brother.